We could simply start, Professor Dian. You spent your entire academic life trying to understand how the world can come together, how we can reach an understanding between all the different cultures, religions, philosophies in the world. And today, there is, of course, a feeling that the world falls apart, that the world is out of order. So, I'm coming from a political perspective. I'm, of course, curious if you, as a philosopher and literary scholar, can help me understand what's going on. So, let me start with a simple question. What does the team, the term world order mean to you? Is there a specific approach from which you can explain what an order of the world is or might be?
Well, there are, I believe, two ways of understanding a word order, which means, for example, that the world would be in order if the reigning order, the current order, continues, meaning that basically we have one superpower, which is the United States, and the world is more or less organized around that one superpower, with a rising superpower, which is China, and that would be one way of understanding the world order. That world order, by the way, is what is being questioned now with the rise of other regional powers and also regroupments and gatherings and coalitions that are questioning that world order. But I believe that more fundamentally, the world order we should be looking for is what I like to call in my work a truly universal universalism. In other words, just shift of power or emerging powers are not going to create really an order. The word order means really putting together what I call this new universalism, which could be a form of multi and true multilateralism in the world.
I know you're very much influenced by the French philosopher Merleau-Ponty,
yes,
who
yes.
spoke of lateral
exactly.
lateralism in
yes.
contrast to vertical orders. But of course, the question is the idea of universalism, which, as you explained, at least in the post-war period, or that's when it was constructed as we know it today, if this universalism does work in that way, or mm-hmm. whether it doesn't need kind of hierarchies, powers that implement rules or have the power to sanction if there are if the global order is violated.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. And in that sense, that even that order that was born out of the Second World War needs, obviously, to be revisited. Let's look at, for example, the United Nations, because that is where all states gather and try to think about the order in which we are living. The African continent, 54 countries, and the African continent is not represented in the Security Council, for example. That is some anomaly when it comes to really thinking of an order of the world. This is why I'm just acknowledging the world order as it is being questioned in many different ways, but also opposing to that something more fundamental as a true order where humanity is really coming together. And humanity cannot come together if you have a whole continent like Africa totally marginalized that way, 54 countries, while everybody is agreeing that in a generation or so, 40% of the population of the world is going to be in Africa and the youngest population at the same time. So it is probably time for us to rethink the totality of what we call the world order and the very principle by which we are ordering the world precisely and try to work towards a true multilateralism. And you are absolutely right. The notion of a lateral universal is for the time being, some kind of philosophical ideal or even idealist idea of all cultures and languages coming together and forging together a horizon of universality in a lateral way without no overarching power dictating what universal should be. It is idealist, but that is where we need to go if you want to think of an order that would be truly a universal order of the world, because it would be a human order of the world.
If we speak, for example, about the distribution of seats in the UN Security Council, this might be just a matter of balance of power. I spoke in this podcast series with John Mearsheimer, one of the most still influential figures of international realism, who, as you know, says the global world is a jungle. It's about survival of the fittest. It's anarchy. There can be no such thing as a global order. It's only about nation states struggling for their survival and for an equilibrium of power that allows them to survive. And the question to you, of course, as a philosopher, is if a global order, a universal lateralism, can mean more shared values, for example, which of course was part of the Western concept of a global order, which also implies, for example, universal human rights.
Absolutely, absolutely. And this is something we have to fight for. Obviously, universal human rights, in my view, are the very foundation of that lateral universalism that I'm calling for. And I always think that René Cassin was right, preferring the word, insisting on the word universal, which is not just international. International would mean that nations come together, look at the real balance of power, and make agreements according to who they are as nations. But the idea that there is something more fundamental than just our division into tribes and nations, something that has that is deeply rooted in our shared humanity, is something that we should be looking at when we think about a new global order. But now, I understand realism, obviously, and things could start changing precisely because of realism. I give you an example. Right now, European, let's say, Western countries have been shocked that there is such a thing as the global South that did not follow what was supposed to be a decision easy to make, which is condemn Russia because of the aggression against Ukraine. And here is the world realizing that, well, we need the African countries if we want to really build a new order, which has to do with marginalizing Russia. And right now you can't do that because you have these countries that are looking at their own interest, no matter how they define it. It is not the question here, but not following suit and just saying, no, we are not doing this. So the world is realizing that you cannot just continue to ignore for example, African countries when it comes to defining the word order. Yeah. So, and that is probably the reason why, at one point, the African Union has been accepted among the G20. They have a seat now. It doesn't solve it. It is highly symbolical, etc. But even because by realism, sensing that something has to change and nations that did not have a seat have to come and have a seat is to realize that power is shifting. There might be a power in the sheer number of African countries, especially if history means something and the history of African Union becoming more and more integrated works.
Yeah.
So that is the realistic path, I would say, towards the more idealistic goal of having.
And what would the idealistic part of it be? That must include something like values, not just quantitative, a quantitative number of seats in the UN Security Council. And of course, I would say I followed that very closely as a political correspondent. Germany started to realize, I would say, with the refugee and migration crisis in 2015, that there is a continent like Africa. Angela Merkel started traveling to Africa, Merkel, and her successor, Olaf Scholz, started inviting countries from Africa, from South America, from Asia to the G7 summits in Germany. There is a new attention, but they both, and the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz said it very explicitly, they are confronted with countries, with heads of state saying, your world order was full of double standards. It was full of hypocrisy of the West. So I'd like to ask you how you perceive this Western American-dominated world order as somebody who has grown up in Senegal, who is influenced by Islamic thinking, mm-hmm. and now is sitting here in this wonderful American mm-hmm. university in Colombia.
I could understand where that comes from. And yes, indeed, when countries like Africa, especially the youth now, denounce what they consider as sheer hypocrisy, they have the impression that the discourse of values is a kind of national narrative of Europe. But when it comes to really realization and considering the rest of the world, those values do not always manifest themselves. I mean, there is history in the first place, the history of colonialism, the fact that colonialism could just be the real negation of the values that were claimed to be European values at the same time. You could have a colonial country colonizing another country and having the sense that values are for the word of civility, and that in the word of barbarism, you can act differently. So forced labor, everything. So that is the memory of colonialism. And today, the idea of a double standard was manifest again when it about the concerning the war in Ukraine. The idea that here is the Europe jumping all over the place, saying this is a catastrophe, how come there is this war, while the rest of the world was used to war. So it is just that because the war is now at the doors of Europe, inside Europe, that there was this call to arms in a way. So that is what you hear people say. And they compare Ukraine and Israel, for example, and Palestine, rather. Of course, it's not the same situation. The circumstances are different. The histories are different. But it is easy for these people to make this kind of rapprochement and think that, yes, the standards change according to who is involved, really. But that being said, yes, the ideal type of multilateralism that I see needs to be founded primarily on values, and a value in particular, which seems to be the value of all values, the very idea of humanity. Humanity understood as the coming out of tribalisms that are actually fragmenting any kind of world order. Reactions are that we have in this so-called world order are tribal reactions. The type of wars we are fighting now look like tribal wars. Even the language of those wars are tribal languages. And this is why, for me, the concept of Ubuntu that I use very much in my work is very important. Ubuntu, Ubuntu is this concept. Before it was a concept, it was a simple word. Let's not romanticize it. It was a simple word in all Bantu languages, because its very constitution is according to the structure of all Bantu languages. Ubuntu, we hear the word Bantu in Ubuntu because it is the same root. So it was simply a word with multiple meanings, as in all languages, words have multiple meanings. That could mean humanity, compassion, fraternity, etc. So we see the semantic field of that word. Mandela famously defined it as saying, by saying, oh, it is just making the community better, making community in the first place. And now the word, which was a simple word, was constructed as a concept, meaning something that has to be efficient in building something, in responding to a political situation. How do I respond to the political situation of a fragmented, totally fragmented society by apartheid, which divided everybody in tribes and asked everybody to stay in their tribes and their lanes and have parallel developments? How do I move from there to a real nation? According to the promise that was the promise of the meeting in 1955 that happened and that produced the so-called Freedom Charter, which was supposed to be the foundation of the new South Africa, where you had both people from ANC, also progressive whites, etc., etc. So Ubuntu played that role. It was now really constructed as a concept to play that role. And it seems to me that that is where we are. In a world of apartheid, a world order which looks very much like apartheid, we need some form of global Ubuntu. Coming out of tribes to have to assign to ourselves a horizon of universality, a horizon of humanity. Now, it could sound naive, but the reason why it is naive is that where is humanity if we are witnessing what we are witnessing? Babies and women dying now in the wars that we are fighting much more than the warriors themselves, etc. But precisely because of that, we need to hold even more firmly the ethical orientation towards an idea of Ubuntu, towards an idea of shared humanity. And that was the bet of Mandela and Desmond Tutu. They did not fully realize it, but at least they showed a direction.
Yeah. You mentioned some words now who are, of course, highly controversial, politicized, like apartheid today. Some may immediately think about the Middle East conflict, about the Israeli situation, and we may speak in this conversation about that as well. But I want to go back to that term Ubuntu, and I remember I heard it must have been in school from Desmond Tutu at the time, I think when he received the Peace Nobel Prize in the 80s, mid-80s it was, I think. But can you explain, does this concept, this idea has specific roots in an African way of thinking, which is different from a European way of thinking, which may also be different from European concepts, Western concepts of state, of law.
Indeed. And that is the reason why Desmond Tutu himself, in his, in a, one of his book, had this, I quote that passage often, when he says that the word Ubuntu is very difficult to translate into a Western language. I mean, it is untranslatable in a way. What I gathered from it, from my readings of texts, philosophical texts coming from South African colleagues, and what I gather also from comparative approach, because I compare it also to the word in my own language, Wolof, Nite, is that there are two main components in the word. One is the idea that humanity is not a state. It is a task. We have to become human. Humanity, in a way, can be defined as the responsibility of achieving our humanity. That one is one component. The other component is that we do it in reciprocity and in connection with each other, with one another. There is even a translation by this Kenyan philosopher who famously said that it is Ubuntu means I am because we are. So some kind of collectivist understanding of what it means to be to be human. But let's look at that, the idea that we have to achieve our humanity and we have to achieve it together. This is the thinking really behind that concept, and this is how it was constructed to be a precise response to the political challenge of building what has been called the Rainbow Nation.
And where does this concept, these ideas, differ from what we know as a European Western concept of universalism? I mean, in philosophy, we might have to go back to Kant, mm-hmm. to the idea of a perpetual peace, mm-hmm. of the concept of the categoric imperative. And of course, speaking about Kant, we also have to ask if the concept of double standards is somehow inherent mm-hmm. to a Western concept of global order, because we can't read Kant today without remembering that he was a staunch racist.
He was, because, yes, he had this sublime notion of what it means to be human, to have the law shine in my heart, just like the sky full of stars and moon, etc., etc. And at the same time, yes, he had to say what he had to say in his anthropology and his geography.
How do you deal with it? Reading Kant today, and also knowing about his race theories.
It is difficult to separate the two, because one would be tempted to say that, okay, the core philosophy of Kant is what he says in the Critique of Practical and Pure Reason, and then the anthropology and the geography is just something that we could ignore, especially given that it was not something he wrote directly, but lectures he gave to students, etc. But one has to take that into account and just realize that everything he was saying about the human in general or humanity in general actually never included certain populations. So there is this huge divide that is made primarily to the articulation of the ethical or the political discourse. You might talk about humanity, the rights of the human, the sublime nature of the human being, after having made a huge divide that actually excluded from everything you say about humanity large amounts of populations. So we have to take that very seriously and think of humanism, so-called European humanism, being built also upon the exclusion of black and brown populations out of the humanity that is in question. That is something that is that I take into account in philosophy. So if I read Kant alongside with a friend of mine who is European, I would be more sensitive to those passages and their full meaning probably than him or her. She might be wanting to dismiss those pages as un-Kantian, mm-hmm. but the question of what if Kant was truly in that divide that he realizes between a European humanity and the rest of the world, rather than in the general universal affirmation of the worth of the human being as a bearer of the sublime law of mm-hmm. treating the other in as myself, not as a means, but always as an end. It's not sure that you are treating as an end someone who is too brown or too black.
And of course, the story goes on in Western philosophy. You pointed out the importance of Hegel.
Yes.
For our concepts of Western, of Western universalism, mm-hmm. and the fact that Hegel held his lectures in Berlin in the Humboldt Universität at the very moment when the modern colonialism started, and that he welcomed and celebrated France for occupying Algeria, because that was the moment, in his view, when Western European universalism had a chance to spread in the dark spheres of the African hemisphere. So How would you see these connections, these interactions between philosophy and policy, which we see here so closely together in these years at the beginning of the 19th century?
Absolutely. I see them deeply internally connected. It is no coincidence that when he was giving those lectures on the universal history, which is primarily European, because only Europe could be the scene of universal history. What happened in 1830 and France conquered Algiers seemed to him a kind of verification of what it meant for Europe to conquer the rest of the world and to be the real scene for universal history. So philosophy here and politics are deeply connected. Those years were the year when the very fabrication of the history of philosophy as something uniquely European was being made. End of 18th century, beginning of 19th century, especially by someone like Hegel, who just cleaned out the history of philosophy of everybody who is not European. So philosophy had to be a Greek miracle that was continued throughout Europe. And even the Arabs, who had some intervention in that same history, who actually inherited Greek philosophy, translated it into Arabic, and then appropriated it also, were wiped out of that history in a certain way, because they would say, their language anyway is not universal enough to really carry the weight of philosophy, and their religion was so fanatic that it could not really be an atmosphere for philosophical thinking. So this fabrication of the history of philosophy as quintessentially European and defining Europe, being the very definition of Europe, was connected with the history of colonialism. And that connection is not just coincidental. I think it was truly something significant that we are studying today, when we need to decolonize precisely the history of philosophy, which is the history that I learned myself as someone who was trained in the history of philosophy in France.
When we are looking at the history of decolonization, which is so important in the second half of the 20th century, I know that also one event which, from my perspective, was a predominantly political event was so important. That was the Bandung Conference in 1955, a conference where around 30 states, which were liberated from colonial rule, came together in Bandung in Indonesia. Tell me why you, from a philosophical point of view, think that this conference is so important.
There are two reasons why this conference of Bandung was very important. Actually, in terms of its content, it was not that important, because what were the declarations and the content of the declaration made after Bandung? General condemnation of colonialism, which was okay, that was a very important content. But the most important aspect was the conference itself. This was the first time that an international conference was called by someone other than Europe. And Europe was not even present. Europe was at the center of the conversation because it was a discussion about colonialism and a radical condemnation of colonialism. But among countries from Asia and Africa, most of the Asian countries already independent, a couple of already independent countries from Africa, but mainly movement of liberation. I think Ghana was there. It was going to be independent 2 years later. But this conference happened without having been organized by Europe. And this was very important. The second reason being that this meant the kind of eruption of African and Asian countries and cultures and languages on that scene of universal history from which they were absent precisely, to connect this with what we said about Hegel. And this is why I consider this the symbol, the very symbol of decolonization. Of course, countries had been decolonized before. India and Pakistan were already independent since 1947, and independence of the African countries would have to wait another 5 years to start happening. But symbolically, that conference, because of its very configuration, was the beginning of a new history and a new world history, where these countries basically by their presence at Bandung were saying, now history has to take us into account. Universal history cannot be the history of one single province of the world. It has to be a braid of histories. So it is a realization on the plane of histories in the plural of what I have called also the lateral universal. It was, in a way, the configuration, the physical translation of a lateral universal.
There's one term that remained from Bandung, of course, which is the spirit of Bandung, which influenced generations, maybe you as well. And I remember the Belgian author David van Reybroek, who wrote a fascinating book about the independence of Indonesia, who compared Bandung, the meaning of Bandung for the global South, with the meaning of the French Revolution to the Western Hemisphere. But of course, we also see that it's a crossroads in history, and that a part of it was a dead end. Many of the participants of the Bandung Conference, like Sukarno, became authoritarian. Sukarno, the first Indonesian president, they became authoritarian rulers. Others, they're wiped away in coups, many of them promoted by the United States of America. So what remained, for example, in the movement of the non-aligned states, mm-hmm. and yeah. what could have become out of this spirit of Bandung?
Well, yeah, I like the word spirit, because a spirit, by definition, is not material. And that means that the spirit remains, even though materially something else than what was intended and or what transpired at that time, the kind of zeitgeist that emerged from it has been betrayed. Yeah, the spirit can be betrayed. It has been. Sukarno turned out to be who he was. The many of the people who were there turned out to be very authoritarian, etc., etc. But what it represented historically, the kind of break in history that it represented, the reason why Senghor said that it was the most important event
Leopold
of the 20th
Senghor,
century. Yes,
the Senegalese politician and poet,
philosopher, and the first head of state of Senegal, called it the most important event in the 20th century. He had lived through the First World War, the Second World War, but why was he saying that? Because he thought that this was a huge turning point. It was exaggeration, maybe, to say that. But the idea that humanity came together to say that nobody has any right to colonize another people under the pretext of civilizing them was a turning point in the history of humanity, which had been a history of colonization. I mean, empires have existed. So this idea of condemning the very notion of empire and a right to colonize was indeed a turning point. So that is the spirit of Bandung. And also the spirit of coming together with many different countries. And you are right, the following movement of the non-aligned was a kind of child of Bandung. 6 years later, in 61, I think, was the Belgrade Conference.
I around, have to look it up, yeah.
Yeah, around that date. But and that's, that Bandung, in a way, is still our horizon. If we take seriously that spirit, we could think that the need to have a world built on a lateral notion of universality and its political translation being true multilateralism is in the spirit of Bandung, And this is a horizon to which, towards which we should be going, rather than just considering that Bandung is 1955 and the past.
Mm-hmm. I found it interesting to notice that though few people know about Bandung in Germany, the German Chancellor, Olaf Scholz, in his recent speech in the UN General Assembly, a few days before October 7th, before the Hamas attack of October 7th, mentioned the importance of Bandung Conference in his speech. And a few weeks earlier, in summer, a planned exhibition in Germany, in one of the major exhibition centers in Berlin, in the Gropiusbau, was cancelled because of fears that this exhibition could include anti-Semitic expressions. What do you make out of that? Is it true, and some people claimed, that a specific form of Israel-related anti-Semitism also has its origins in Bandung? Obviously, the Palestinian cause was an issue in the Bandung Conference. It ended with a call for a two-state solution. What do you make out of that?
It is, and it is a very difficult question, because obviously, as we are talking about history and knowing what the history of Holocaust has been, we have to be absolutely wary of anything that could open the door to any kind of anti-Semitic attitudes or declarations or acts, for that matter. I taught this semester Franz Fanon, mm-hmm. who is in the spirit of Bandung, who is this kind of icon of decolonial thought, a representation of Bandung. And we were reading Black Skin, White Mask, and remembering the humanist Franz Fanon, the Franz Fanon who speaks like I was trying to speak about something. The word Ubuntu is not there, but it is in a way present, because he was calling our shared humanity. And he had in that book this very important declaration when he says, if you hear someone saying something against a Jew, listen carefully, because that someone is talking about you. So the idea was there in this book that no matter what we our deep engagement in the Palestinian cause, but and that needs to be affirmed, because here we have a people that is occupied and or second citizen, etc., and this has to end. The decision of the United Nations to have two countries side by side has to be implemented, and we cannot keep living in a world where we think that, well, the Palestinian question, as it is called, can be managed. Well, managed until when? It is unbearable to think that a country depends on for drinking water on another country. It is as if Mali actually could shut down the faucets in Senegal, and that whether or not I have water depends on Mali. So this is a situation that needs to end. But at the same time, I can understand why in this kind of very volatile atmosphere, where the language once again is a tribal language, one is very wary of any kind of demonstration that could bring in things such as anti-Semitism or Islamophobia, for that matter. I mean, in this country where we are, in the United States where I live, one child has been stabbed because he was Muslim. He is, yes. And three Palestinians have been shot because they are Palestinians. So we have to realize what tribalism means here, and try in our language, the political language with which we talk about the situation, make sure that we do not let any form of anti-Semitism or Islamophobia slip in and keep it political.
But as you mentioned, Frantz Fanon, who is so important for the post-colonial thinking, of course, he's also the one who explained how the colonialized becomes a new type of colonializer. Mm. He becomes a violent figure, mm-hmm. a murderer. So Frantz Fanon is also quoted by some to explain, by some so they are excused to legitimize acts like we've seen them by Hamas terrorists when we look at the conflict of the Middle Eastern conflict, be it right or not, in parallels to colonial conflict. So the question is, the topical question is, by what means can we change world orders? And the fight for against colonialism was again and again a violent fight. Mm-hmm. And this question seems to become very acute and very topical, very controversial and loaded.
Yes, and this is why I am coming back to the political, ethical meaning of Ubuntu, combining the two. Of course, the Fanon of the Wretched of the Earth actually had this very violent language about colonialism being, by essence, violence, and anti-colonialism needing to be violent. So, yes, that Fanon has been evoked, along usually with Sartre, Jean-Paul Sartre, who wrote the preface, a preface that seemed also to be a kind of legitimation of any kind of violence, of terrorist violence, given the cause that that violence is supposed to serve. And but this is precisely where Ubuntu, again, is very important for me. Ubuntu was articulated by a man, Mandela, who had this trajectory of someone who called for violence against the inhuman regime of apartheid, and who ended precisely being this philosopher of Ubuntu, which did not mean abandoning any aspect of the struggle and the reason for the struggle, for the emancipation of the human in general, both the oppressor and the oppressed, because in his language, when you read him, oppression is something that is oppressive for everybody. In a way, the one who was watching him in his jail was as much jailed in a situation as he himself was. And so always shedding the light of our shared humanity on our engagements is something very important. It is very important to say, for example, that you cannot attack civilians, you cannot take hostages babies, I mean, four-year babies are being liberated. You can't do that. And you have to have the moral clarity of saying things like that. And it gives you the moral clarity also to say that Palestinians being in this kind of open prison that Gaza is unacceptable. And the fact that humanity in its totality cannot just sit together and say, well, this situation has been lasting for too long. After all, can't we design two states living side by side and trying to do some justice to a population that since 1948 has been a population of refugees or occupied or second-class citizen? That is how we shed the light of Ubuntu on our demand for justice, and how we try to achieve the moral clarity we need to achieve when we condemn what we have to condemn, etc. In my own Muslim terms, and allow me to talk about the fact that I work also in Islamic philosophy, I have a very simple question. Can I imagine Prophet Muhammad ordering an expedition where the soldiers are going to bring back as hostages women and children. I cannot.
But many can. I mean, those who did it in the name of the Prophet and in the name of Islam.
No, no. Because if I pose that question in the terms that I have posed right now to you, I believe that even the leaders of Hamas would say that they cannot imagine it. I know my religion. I know Islam. I know the Prophet Muhammad. I don't see any Muslim actually capable of saying that he could order an expedition such as that one. That is what I call moral clarity.
We are touching now a discussion which is so polarized. And even when we are talking about an idea like Ubuntu and a figure like Desmond Tutu, many in German would remind you that Desmond Tutu was a supporter of the BDS movement, which is labeled bluntly anti-Semitic in Germany. And today, Desmond Tutu would rarely be given a public stage in Germany because BDS supporters are consequently banned from the public sphere in Germany. So what would you say? Who has to learn here if we want to come to an understanding? Is it the West who has to understand Ubuntu colonial theories, which are also blamed for promoting anti-Semitism these days? Or is it the southern countries? Is it philosophers like Achille Mbembe, for example, who was so heavily criticized in Germany and also practically banned from public stages? Do they have to learn about uniqueness of the Holocaust, about Western history, about things you can't legitimately compare?
I mean, of course, lessons of history is something that exists, that we have to take into account. And this is what makes the situation also something that one has to be very careful in characterizing. If you use categories such as colonialism, etc., you are ignoring the history of the presence of Israel and the creation of Israel, and so on and so forth. So this is why I always say that the best way is to start with the end. In other words, if the end should be two states living side by side, that end itself sort of determines the language that you are going to use, because who you are going to oppose are the extremes who are against that and who work against that. And you have the right to condemn those. Both the extremists who are trying to make impossible the existence of a Palestinian state, than the extremists who are trying to destroy the already existing state of Israel. So if you have that kind of moral clarity, I think you can try to articulate the political discourse that this situation calls for. And any other thing becomes a blurring of lines. You don't want to cross lines when you seem to be falling into some form of dehumanization of the not just the Palestinians, but the Muslims in general, turning this into a war of religion that seems to allow you to speak in human languages, dehumanizing other people, calling them animals, etc., calling them names, or on the other side, falling into sheer anti-Semitism. And this is what is the difficulty with this situation. But again, starting with what the end, as I say, helps articulate a discourse that is demanding in terms of social justice. You ask for social justice, and at the same time, you ask for the solution that everybody agrees is the only, should be the only solution, two states living side by side. I've been interviewed right after October 7, and I have said this, that moral clarity demands that you say it is unacceptable to attack civilians the way civilians have been attacked. And moral clarity demands that you affirm the rights of the Palestinians to have a state and live as a nation like everybody like everybody else. And this is crucial in a situation like the one we are living in. And I've also said that people who have assassinated Yitzhak Rabin knew what they were doing. Here is probably a man who would have realized this, and his assassination, in a way, has led us to the situation in which we are. So we can't have another Yitzhak Rabin, but what he represented is still with us, and it is up to us, to the international community, and to people who insist on world order. World order demands, be it the realist one or the more idealist one, but demands that this finds a solution.
Mm-hmm. Last question, maybe. How do you experience and interpret the situation here on a campus, which also was in the news because of demonstrations, Jewish students feeling threatened by protesters? When I came to your office, I saw the protests here on the stairs of in Columbia campus, and I was wondering, it was mostly the ones I saw shouting free Palestine from the river to the sea. It was mostly white young students. There seems to be something moving them in a special way. How do you see that? And
it should be added, I mean, this is kind of very rapid sociology that should be refined. But it should be added that many of those actually who are asking for free Palestine are also Jewish students. I mean, you have an organization here, a voice of
Jewish Voices for Peace.
For peace, etc. Mm-hmm. So there is something that here goes beyond appurtenances.
But it's extremely polarized. And I spoke to also the colleagues from Columbia,
and I experienced it,
who say it's practically impossible. It's so difficult to have this discourse. And
it is
who you, as somebody who so much believes in the possibility of a discourse, of translation of different languages, also as a political principle, what prospects, what chances do you see to bring that polarized situation in a fruitful, productive discourse?
I am on the side of those who say one has to insist, both for rational reasons, because it is general agreement that the solution has to be the solution of two states. And also for profoundly philosophical reason. I mean, I live this situation, it's very bad for me, because I'm sure I know that I have students on both sides, and that when they have demonstrations at the same time, it is very probable that if I approach those demonstrations, which I do not do, I would recognize students of mine on both sides, especially the class I'm teaching on the history of Islamic philosophy as this intellectual and spiritual tradition, where I have many students that I would expect to be on both sides. And it is complicated for everybody, because we are all pressured to take positions. And actually, nobody is waiting for you to really take what might be called a position. They want you to take side, which is different. And the administration also is pressured to make a declaration in this direction or that direction, etc. So we are all living that situation of radical separation, where it looks like you cannot bring the different parties together to have a discourse, an exchange, and share the same public sphere. Difficult, but not impossible. Probably at this point where of boiling atmosphere, it is impossible. I mean, October 7 is close. The bombardments and the numbers rising in Gaza are appearing every single night on our television. But there must be the time when people understand that the only way out is Ubuntu. Rwanda came out of a genocide of the Tutsi. What do you do after such a genocide of the Tutsi except try to put together some form of Ubuntu? That is to say, saying that the actions that we have to take now are going to be dictated not by what has happened, not by the past, but by the future. And this is what I call starting with the end, saying that the actions to be taken now are going to be dictated by this image that is for the time being a very blurred, vague image of two countries being side by side and or people sitting around the table trying to design those two countries. But it is what we have to draw our actions and our language today from. That is my fundamental belief.
Professor Diani, many thanks for your time.
I thank you very much for having me and sharing this conversation with you.
Thank you.